When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, so you should have your review up, and let's get going. So first off, the test is a whole bunch of multiple choice questions from pretty much all the units we've covered. So units 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And then there's two FRQs. The one FRQ, I'll go over kind of in the review. And the second one is a very broad one. Please keep in mind that I won't grade the FRQs until either the coming weekend, so like the 3rd, 4th, 5th, somewhere in there, or if everybody has finished the test by like Wednesday, then I'll try and grade it on Thursday or something like that. So, but I won't grade them until everybody has done the FRQs. All right. All right. Let's get moving with the content. And I got my notes in front of me, so if it looks like I'm just reading, well, I kind of am for some of this stuff because I'm trying to move quick, and it's just easier this way. All right, Gilbert White, he's an English naturalist, and his big contribution is going to be in the area of natural history, and he has a work called The Natural History and Antiquities of Selborne, and he gets into the flora and the fauna of the area around his home there. All righty. So that's Gilbert White. So when you see him on the test, you'll know who he is. Freshkill, you've seen this question a couple of times, I believe. This is the largest landfill in the world and just took waste from all over New York City. It's closed now and it's trying to be turned into a park. Reactions to natural hazards. You've seen this question before. This is just how we as individuals respond to some of the natural hazards or how the government responds to natural hazards or communities or whoever we might be talking about. For us, we're probably talking about us. And just, you know, what happens. So some of the, let's say there's an earthquake somewhere, you know, natural reactions to those things for a lot of people is to, you know, maybe move away from an earthquake zone. Maybe if there something happens, if an earthquake hits and buildings are damaged or something like that, people are going to leave. Hurricanes, you know, people that live in hurricane zones, they're going to build their houses on stilts and things like that. So just some of the ways that people can either be prepared for natural hazards or some of the things that we do when a natural hazard strikes. Valley of the Drums, you've seen this one before. That is that area in Kentucky that has drums upon drums upon drums of hazardous chemicals. And it's been cleaned up, or they've tried to anyways. PVI in city centers. So PVI, remember that stands for Population Vulnerability Index. And it refers to the level of vulnerability of a population living in a city center. All right, to the various, pollution, think socioeconomic issues, just basically what are some things that could possibly happen to people living in this area. High density urban areas. So these are areas in the cities that have just a whole bunch of people in a small area. Okay. Think about all the people that live in an apartment building. I saw a social media post about an apartment complex, and I think it was either in China or maybe Dubai. I can't remember. Anyways, there was 30,000 people living in the apartment complex. Now, it was a huge apartment complex, but 30,000 people in one complex just blows my mind. But that's what we're talking about when we talk about that. Homer Hoyt, an American economist, he's going to study urban development and land use patterns. So some of the land use stuff. He develops a sector model of urban land use And that is the sectors, you know, going out from the central business district. So this is something we've covered several times now. So hopefully it's something you're familiar with. Features of middle-aged trading cities. I feel like this was kind of random, but we've seen it before. So remember that these areas in the Middle Ages, they're going to need to be close to travel. So like rivers is going to be a big place for these trading cities, because they got to be able to get the product to and from the markets and things like that. They're also going to be fortified already. Most of these cities are going to be needing protection. And so a lot of them will have these giant walls. And so around water or just transportation, you know, some kind of transportation hub. Green belts, these are areas of undeveloped land surrounding urban areas. And it's trying to kind of offer up a break maybe from the urban sprawl that happens. Some places will have green belts like in the middle of them. Some places will have green belts around the city. It just depends on who's developing and creating the city, where the green belts will be located. Influential cities of the world economically, there are many of them. New York City is probably the first one that comes to mind for people. Tokyo is going to be a big one. London has a big economic, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of force in the world. So those are some places. And you know, a lot of times it's all about the financial services. Like in New York, it's got bank upon bank upon bank. It's got Wall Street and other stock market stuff. So lots of stuff going on economically in those cities. Primate cities, those are urban areas that disproportionately dominate the country. Okay. Think of economics, politics, just everything. Okay. Is going to be that city is going to be the focus. And they're large. They usually have large populations versus the rest of the country. Squatter cities. These are informal settlements. You've seen this question before. And they think of like some of the maybe homeless encampments and things like that. They might be a little bit better off than some of the stuff we see on the streets of some of the cities in America. But these are places, they're usually outside of the main cities, and it's going to be where there are basically camps, people living in what they can find, whether it be cardboard boxes, little shacks that they've been able to put together from pieces of wood they found. You know, living conditions aren't great in these places. All right. Cultural ecology, that's a field of study that explores the relationship between human societies and their environments. It focuses on how culture shapes and is shaped by the natural environment through kind of what we do already. Think of some of the choices we make for our environment. Hinterland, the surrounding area or region served by a central place, such as city or port. Okay. It's the area where goods, services, things like that are drawn to support the main city. Gentrification. So you've seen this before. This is the process of urban renewal. And basically, it is where wealthy, or I should, maybe not necessarily always wealthy, but people with more money than the normal everyday person that's been living in this area moves into. And they start to put money into the place. Businesses start to come in. Basically, they increase the property values already, and they kind of push the people that have been living there maybe out of the area, because they can't afford the taxes and the prices of goods that are there now. It happens all over the place. Nodal points, CBDs. So nodal points, those are the central business districts, and that's what CBD stands for. And just remember, these are the hubs, the areas of the city where you've got just a concentrated group of establishments for whatever it might be. Think of banking, think of businesses, things like that. It's going to be the kind of the focal point of the city. All right, that's Unit 5. Moving on to 6. Pastoral nomadism. This is a transitional form of subsistence agriculture practiced by nomadic pastoralists, which we've talked about. I know it's a long time ago in the first semester, but stuff that we have talked about. Remember, these are individuals who are going to basically be herding their animals and just moving around from place to place wherever they can find the best resources for their livestock and their livelihood. Alrighty. And these groups are going to move, like I said, they're going to move to where the best areas are for their livestock so that they can take care of them. And they'll move from season to season, so on and so forth. Crop complex, that refers to a group of crops that are commonly grown together in a specific region or agricultural system. And they are grown because they are compatible with the local environment. So y'all haven't done U.S. history in high school yet, because I think most of you are freshmen. But if you remember anything about U.S. history from your earlier days, you probably have talked about Virginia and tobacco. Okay, tobacco became kind of the focal point of colonial Virginia. And it worked because it worked with the soil. Same thing with like rice in South Carolina. It became kind of the focal point for those places. Primary sector economic activity. Primary sector includes economic activities that involve pulling raw materials from natural resources. And that is their kind of focus. They are the raw material people. So think of like cutting down trees and getting the tree so it can be made into lumber for building houses and furniture or whatever else people use wood for. Okay. So that would be a primary sector activity where we're going to pull the raw material. My wife's about to come into the, so if the bell rings or my dogs go crazy or she starts talking, I apologize. I never can say it correctly. Sector economic activity. This is the second part of the primary. This is where you've got the raw materials now. The raw material has been sent to you, and now you're making something out of them. Okay, so here's the lumber. Here's the trees. Now you make it into something. So we take the wood and make it into lumber, and then it gets turned into housing. Subsistence farming. Early societies, I think y'all are familiar with the subsistence farming. That's doing enough for you and your family, basically. So you're farming, and you're getting what you need done. And you can survive off of that. There's not going to be much extra. There's not going to be much left over to trade and send to other places. You just kind of do what you got to do. In early societies, this is what people did. IR36, that is a high yield variety of rice. Okay. It was created during the Green Revolution specifically to try and increase food production. All righty. So that's all IR36 is. Farmers' problems shared by developed and developing countries. This is, you've seen this question before. I'm not sure I'm a huge fan of it, but, there it is. And just farmers everywhere are going to face some of the same problems. Think of like access to land. You know, think of all the land that people are buying up, so they could put houses on, stores on, and things like that. So farmers are going to constantly struggle to keep their land as people look to develop and build. Alrighty, access to water. Water is going to be an issue. Think about in the West, the western part of the United States, they're going through a huge mega drought. You know, our lakes are drying up. The rivers are failing a little bit because there's not as much snow melt and things like that. And so water is severely restricted out there. And so farmers face those issues. So just some of the issues that every farmer is going to face, pests, diseases are going to hit, frosts are going to hit, things like that. Shifting cultivation. This is also known as slash and burn agriculture. And it's where land is cleared by cutting and burning vegetation before planting crops. And after a few years, they'll just redo the process. Carrying capacity, that refers to the maximum population that an environment can sustain. I have talked about this almost every time we've talked about carrying capacity. You know, just some of the areas around the globe, you got to wonder at what point is the tipping point for, You know, how many people can this area support? Intensive subsistence. I can't talk. This is a form of agriculture, and it involves the intensive use of labor and inputs on small plots to maximize crop yields. And there's my wife, so I apologize. I can't find a quiet spot in my house. The primary factor in von Thunen's model, this model of agricultural land use is typically going to be the transportation costs. The model suggests that farmers will allocate land use based on the cost of transporting agricultural products to the market, with the perishable things that are going to go bad and high value crops located closer to the market, and the less perishable things a little bit further away. Agriculture as a job. I think you need to remember that agriculture as a job is decreasing. Less and less people are staying in agriculture. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, one of the big ones is small farms just aren't as successful as they used to. So people used to grow up and take over their family farm and be able to live a, you know, good, comfortable life. And it's just, it's not as easy as it used to be. So people, you know, move away from the farms and things like that. Commercial grain producers. So that's what it says it is. People that are going to produce grain, at the commercial level, they're going to be huge farms. And some of the huge country, some of the countries that produce lots of grain, think of the United States, Canada, places like that. Relocation diffusion. This is a type of cultural diffusion where ideas are spread from one place to the other through the physical movement of people. In the context of agriculture, it is going to include farming techniques, different planting techniques, you know, how do we protect our crops, things like that. And then plantation farming, that's that large-scale agricultural production system. And it's where you got one crop typically on a huge part of land. You know, think of cash crops. I mentioned tobacco in Virginia back in the day. So think of that. Things just, there's all kinds of plantation crops, coffee, in places in South America, all kinds of things. All right, unit 7, commodity export economies. So they rely heavily on the export of primary commodities such as the raw materials. Okay. And they often face challenges, due to the price and global commodity markets. So basically, if someone's not buying your product, you're going to run into problems because you're going to have this product build up, in your storage containers. And what do you do with it? It's just sitting there. Comparative advantage. So comparative advantage, we got the two things. We got absolute and comparative. Absolute advantage. That's where I can do, or as a country, I can produce everything I need to produce. However, we don't want to do that. We want to do comparative advantage where we decide what one person, one country should specialize in and then trade with the other country. So we got to figure out who has the lowest opportunity cost and who's going to give up the least by specializing in this one product. And then we trade for the rest. Conspicuous consumption, that refers to the consumption of goods, services, trying to impress people, basically. Production is pretty simple. That's the process of creating goods and services. The Malacadora plants location. So this is one of your FRQs. So pay special attention here to the Malacadora stuff and look into it, as this is going to be the FRQ review as well. So Malacadora, these are manufacturing facilities, and they are typically going to be located in Mexico, and they are going to be typically located close to the U.S.-Mexican border. And they do this so that they can import raw materials tax-free, because we're a tax-free zone, and they can put these things together and then re-export the finished product. And it's all about, you know, tax conditions, favorable conditions, a little bit cheaper labor, and things like that. Okay. So the question on the test, the multiple choice question, is going to be specific to, I think, the plant location. So it's going to be close to the U.S. border. But you also got to be able to talk about them a little bit and some of the stuff that we just mentioned about importing raw materials, building cheaply the finished product, re-exporting it, and things like that. So I don't want to get too specific on the short answer, the FRQ, It's doable. It's something that if you know the concept and know what we just talked about, you should be, I think, in pretty good shape to write. But just maybe, you know, if you don't feel comfortable and want some more information, just maybe take a look or shoot me an email and I'll be happy to talk more about it. Purchasing power parity, PPP. This is a theory in economics that compares the relative value of currencies by comparing the prices of similar groups of goods in different countries. So basically, hey, let's look at milk, bread, and eggs in America. Let's look at the price of milk, bread, and eggs in England or Italy or Brazil or wherever, and let's compare them. That's all that's getting at. Professor Muhammad Yunus, he is going to win a Nobel Prize about microfinance and social businesses. Basically, it is about how to help people that are living in poverty, and how, and that's what microfinance is how can people that are living in poverty, how can they get out of this, and how can the banking system help them? And it was about loans that they could give and get and things like that. Anglo-American manufacturing belt. This is part of the Midwest here in America, and it stretches from New England to the Great Lakes region, and it is known for its manufacturing industrial activity. Okay, it's also called the Rust Belt nowadays because so many people are leaving. Asian Tigers, that is the group of industrialized Asian countries. Think of Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, places like that. And they are just, they have a lot of growth economically going. Silicon Valley is a region in southern San Francisco. It's where all the tech stuff is happening. Okay. Examples of Western values. So think of some of the cultural, political, social principles that have influenced societies in Europe, North America, places like that. And like freedom of choice, individualism, freedom of speech, things like that. The world systems perspective. So this is a theoretical framework in sociology and economics that examines the global economy as an interconnected system of core, semi-peripheral, and peripheral countries. Remember, the core is going to be the big, main, the leaders, okay? America would be a core country. The peripheral, those are going to be what you might hear sometimes called the third world countries. Countries that are struggling, countries that have a high poverty rate and have issues you know, beyond their control sometimes, okay? And then the semi-peripheral is going to be those in the middle. They're not big enough to be the core. They're not in bad enough shape to be considered the peripheral. Okay. And the world systems perspective is just how are we all linked? You know, what are we doing as a world? Autarky, that is a state of economic self-sufficiency where a country or region seeks to produce all the goods and services it needs domestically without relying on international trade. And then Albert Gallatin, he was an American politician. And he is going to be the Secretary of the Treasury under Jefferson and Madison. So he's a long time ago, and he's known for his contributions to financial, some of his financial policies. Okay, all right. So that is the this semester stuff. Okay, so that's this stuff this semester. All right, moving on to the next set of stuff. This is the stuff from the first semester. And try and go quick through this. Unit 1, prime meridian measurement. That is the line of longitude designated as 0. And that's where all other lines of longitude are measured. It passes through the Greenwich. You might hear of it referred to that as that sometimes in London. And is the reference point for kind of splitting the eastern and western hemisphere. Scale, remember that refers to the relationship between the size of an object or area on a map and its actual size in the real world. And it helps us understand the relative size and distance between features on a map. Situation, that refers to the location of a place relative to its surrounding environment and other places. It includes factors such as proximity to transportation routes, access to natural resources, and things like that. Site refers to the physical and cultural characteristics of a specific location. It includes topography, climate, vegetation, soil, some of the things that go into us being sustainable, so humans having sustainable resources there. Globalization of the world economy, very broad question here, a very broad topic, but it just, if you can think about all the interconnectedness we face as a world and how dependent upon we are on other things happening, okay, around the world. That's all that's getting at. Something that happens in the Middle East affects us here. Something that happens here is going to affect the European economy, so on and so forth, because we are kind of connected and dependent upon each other for certain things. Unit 2, the CBR-CDR 10, so that's a formula, and it represents the natural increase rate, so the NIR of a population. So CBR is going to stand for crude birth rate, and CDR stands for the crude death rate. So you take those two numbers and subtract them, and then divide by 10, and it'll give you that NIR, of a the natural increase rate of a population. TFR, total fertility rate, measures the average number of children born to women between 15 and like 45 or so, somewhere in that range in a given population. Okay, so it's a hypothetical number of children a woman should have or would have if she were to bear kids. Large population clusters refer to densely populated regions or areas with high concentrations of people. You can probably think of some of the different large population clusters that are out there. Up in the Northeast, New York City, and that area, huge population. London, Tokyo, Japan, places like that. Infant mortality rate is the number of deaths of infants under 1 year of age per 1,000 live births in a given population. And it's usually going to be measured over the course of a year. And it's used to measure kind of a place's health. You know, if you have a high number of infant deaths, that's not a good sign that you are having the medical resources needed to take care of a population. So that's a sign that can be used. And you know, the infant mortality rate used to be really high. I think it last I had kind of paid attention to the actual numbers. I think it was going down because we do have so many places, at least here in America, where people can get help and babies are living even when they might not should, if that makes sense. Like a preemie, like a baby born, let's say, at 25 weeks. Okay, back in the day, that baby was going to be too small and really had no chance of survival, right? Today, there's little babies that are born super small, super preemie, that's able to survive. Unit 3 just has two things. Ethnocentrism, that's a tendency to judge other cultures, practices, or beliefs based on the standards of your own cultural group, and you often believe that your own culture is superior to others. It can lead to prejudice, discrimination, and things like that. Hopefully that's not an issue with anybody here. Vernacular, that refers to the everyday language or dialect spoken by people in a particular region or community, as opposed to formal or standardized forms of language. So my favorite is the Cajuns down in Louisiana. I used to watch a show on History Channel about gator hunting. They would go out there and they had to put subtitles because you could hardly understand the Cajuns talking. But I love their food. So it's good stuff. All right, Unit 4, the last thing here. Unitary states. So this is a political system where you have a dominant kind of government that's in charge of other smaller places. And then we typically think about this when we think about colonial era. So you had, let's do England. So you had England all over the place, okay? And they had their strong central government that would dictate to their colonies, so America and the 13 colonies, hey, this is what you're going to do. That's a unitary system where you have the strong central government. So you had England with their king and their parliament and things like that, dictating to the smaller subunits, the American colonies, this is what you're going to do. Exclave, a portion of a country or territory that's geographically separated from the main part of the country and surrounded by the territory of another country. Exclaves are going to occur due to geographical features such as rivers, mountains, things like that. So think of Alaska, okay? That's separated from the continental United States, even by Canada, and the areas up there. So we could consider that probably an exclave. Last few things here, compromise capitals. You've seen this before. it's all about those capitals that became the capital because of a compromise. Washington, D.C. is an example of that. Back in the day, the South and the North, they couldn't decide on a place, and eventually the South gave in to some things the North wanted. The North gave in to some things the South wanted, and they came up with Washington, D.C. A political unit, that's a territorial entity or administrative division with defined boundaries and a government that exercises authority over its population and territory. So a political unit is just the area, okay, that government is basically responsible for. And then finally, a Latin word, and I don't know if I've expressed my dislike of Latin before, but it's a dead language. And I'm sorry if you're all into Latin, but it's dead. Like, why are we still using it? But we still do. And I'm mainly bitter about it because I typically can't say these words correctly. Okay. So I'm going to do my best here. Well, Latin. Jus sanguinis. And that is going to mean right of blood. And it's a principle of nationality. Okay. That determines citizenship based on the nationality of citizenship of one's parents rather than the location of one's birth. So if for some reason your parents had went on a cruise, right, while your mom was pregnant with you and had you out on international waters for some reason, went into labor while out at sea, in theory, where are you a citizen of? Well, your parents are a citizen of America, let's say. So that means you're going to be a citizen of this country. So that's all that is. Okay. It's, you have the just soil, which is grant citizenship based on the place of birth. So that's kind of the difference there. All right. Got done in 33 minutes. So that hopefully wasn't too bad. You have seen a lot of these questions before. Take your time with the test. I wish you the best of luck. I said in my email, but I'll say it again on recording, I have appreciated being a part of your journey here. A lot of you are freshmen, so you've got some years to go in your high school career, and then you get to get out of here. But best of luck, seriously, and with all sincerity. If I can ever do anything for you, help you with any socialist classes or anything like that throughout the next couple years, just my email is not going to change, and I'm available to help you out any way I could. Alrighty. But best of luck this week. I'll get these graded once everybody has taken it or over next weekend, and that's when you'll see your grade update, and I will get everything in for you. But have a great end of your semester. Have a fantastic summer, whatever it is you do. And I'll see you when I see you. All right, take care, guys. Bye-bye. Record.